Welcome to Legal Talk with attorney Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law. Auto accidents, DUIs, slip and falls, each one can change your life. But the trial-tested, trial-ready attorneys at Flesh and Beck Law relieve your legal burden. Whether you need to heal from an injury or protect your future in a criminal matter, the legal team at Flesh and Beck Law is prepared to defend your rights. Now, here's Legal Talk with your host, Scott Whatley, and attorney Kevin Flesh.
Welcome to Legal Talk. My name is Scott Whatley, and we want to thank you once again for being with us. Our show is brought to you each week by Flesh and Beck Law, our personal injury attorneys here for KLZ, criminal law as well. 303-806-8886. And always good to have Kevin Flesh in with us, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Scott. Thanks.
How's the last few weeks been?
It's been good. We've been busy. Lots of stuff going on. Had a couple of trials that I thought were going to go that ended up resolving themselves, so I've had a little bit of time to be in the office, which is always nice, catching up on some other stuff. So, Right. Yeah, it's been really good. You know, all the courts are really back up and running. We've got a few. We're still doing a bunch of stuff virtually. Depositions in particular. As a matter of fact, I have one today. So those are all good. But otherwise, you know, trying to be as efficient as possible.
Sure.
And I'm amazed now, having sort of looked back at the last couple of years with COVID, and we've learned some things that we can do really well virtually, and makes things much more efficient and saves clients money, which has been really good. But the courts are sort of making us come back and do things in person, which right. is a lot of driving for very little time in court and sitting around. So that's been a little frustrating. But I think that'll moderate out and we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. Most of the civil stuff is all, you don't really have to travel to courthouses or to other lawyers or go downtown, for example, right, for mediations right. and things. So that's really nice for the client. Client can come to our office. I suppose if we didn't have an office, it would be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, and I know there are lawyers out there that are trying to do things relatively inexpensively and not have an office anymore, especially defense counsel for insurance companies. A lot of them are officing out of their houses, so that's interesting. So they kind of like the virtual world, so they don't have to have a conference room and things like that. Saves them some money. But because we have all of those services available, we've got the ability to do both of those things. And that's, I think it's just a better way to practice personally. But right. It's been good. I have no real complaints. Yeah. Things are going well. The clients have been getting really good results. I've had a couple of cases that I thought I would have some real difficulty resolving that have resolved. So I've been really impressed with the work that our team has been doing.
It's got to be interesting through all your years in your career of just all the different things. It is, you know, personal injury and accidents, but just all the different things people can get into.
Oh, my gosh.
And situations that require some help legally.
Yeah, it's,
I mean, it's going to be crazy. Someday we got to do like the top 20.
Yeah. Yeah, my
Stranger Things,
you
whatever.
Know, that would be a fun show. We probably need a couple because I've got some interesting cases that they come into the – so my staff gives me a hard time because I do kind of like the crazy case.
Right.
Sometimes the fact patterns, they come in and I'm like, I just get a gut reaction to cases sometimes. Like, no, we're going to be able to get something for the client. We're going to be able to add value and we're going to be able to do something in this case, even though it is the strangest thing I've ever heard of, you know? And we get into them, and sure enough, we're able to do that. And so that's always rewarding for us because, you know, your run-of-the-mill motor vehicle rear ender case that we see a lot of those sorts of cases are nice cases to deal with, but it's always kind of fun to have these strange fact patterns that people can ask you about and you can talk about and you get into and sort of laugh about just the, not necessarily that there was an injury, but the just the way things happen. Because, human beings sometimes just do crazy things. And and you can't help but go, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. So, The practice of law is interesting from that standpoint because it's with humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that if I were doing transactional law, for example, and just, you know, leasing of planes or doing other sorts of what I would say more mundane, boring, probably very lucrative things, they're just not as interesting as what shows up at our office on a daily basis about what takes place. And what happens is over almost 25 years, it'll be 25 years that I've been practicing in October, over the years you see some of the same fact patterns happen. And so you get a sense of what people have done in those things, and you can sort of guess as to where it's going to go. What's also interesting is how different insurance companies handle these claims.
Right.
Some insurance guy just settled a case where both, it was in mediation, and we finished settling it. It was a good settlement for the client. But both the mediator and I were talking afterwards, and we said, you know, this particular commercial insurance carrier is much fairer than some of the other insurance carriers out there. And we settled the claim, and if it had been another carrier, I think that other carrier probably would have been five times less what they offered in this particular case. And it would be and so it's super interesting relating to how carriers are handling the claims process and what they value these claims on. And that's super interesting to see, too, because sometimes you're like, when it's to your benefit, you're like, I don't know how we got here, really. And I mean, in my own mind, I'm like, well, I'm making this offer, but
right.
I mean, I don't, some carriers that I know of, I make the offer, I'm like, they won't even get, you know, we're talking about a six-figure case, and they won't get out of the four figures, mm-hmm. you know, and so it's, that's the part of the process and the part of the practice now that I find super interesting to see sort of how things progress, because
right.
sometimes they're more frustrating than they should be, and other times, you know, the insurance companies do what they should.
Yeah,
and that's really beneficial to the client.
Once again, you're listening to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesh, Flesh and Beck Law. Again, the number 303-806-8886. Today we're going to talk about something that I'm telling you, through the 10-plus years Kevin's been on our show here with KLZ and being our attorney here. Small claims court term has come up all throughout the year. I think there's a lot of misnomers, I guess, about small claims court. So we're going to cover as much as we can. But
sure.
When is that a good choice, and what kind of cases can you take there and what can you not?
Right. So small claims court, it is similar to what you see on TV, sort of the people's court sort of thing, especially depending upon which jurisdiction you're in. Many times throughout the state, the judge in the case is a lawyer that just practices regular private practice, and then they do the small claims court as a service for the county. But it's a court of limited jurisdiction. So what that means is that the matters that come to the court are a maximum recovery of $7,500. Generally speaking, lawyers are not able to practice in small claims unless they've given the other side notice, at least 7 days notice of being there and representing a client.
Now, let me ask you this. When you say practice, does that mean you can come and sit with me in there and me and you can talk, or you just can't talk to the judge? Or how to,
I've had talking about that, that's, I've had a number of people over the years that have wanted me to be their lawyer for small claims, and they come to me 5 days before their initial, appearance. And at that point, I'm not able to enter an appearance and appear with them. You have to be at least 8 days or more out from the hearing so that the lawyer can enter their appearance. Because what the reason that the rule is there is that once I enter, let's say you're the defendant in the case, and that's normally what it is, you've been served in small claims court, and you have to show up on a particular day. And 7 days prior to that particular day on that first appearance, if you decide you want to have a lawyer, you have to have that lawyer enter their appearance and physically provide a piece of paper to the court saying, I'm representing this client. If you don't do that, if you do it on day six, the court will say, yeah, that's not a good entry of appearance, and lawyer, and I've had this happen to me, you can't actually practice in this court on that day. Now, I can be there. I can talk with the client. I can give them advice. I've done that. I've sat next to them in the chair while the hearing is going on, giving the client advice about what to do. But I can't actually get up and question witnesses and present evidence do anything else. I literally am then...
You're a buddy.
I'm a buddy. Yeah. You're of counsel, so to speak. You're advisory counsel is what you really are.
Okay.
Because we see that in other cases, in criminal cases, like where maybe a person has decided, I've been advisory counsel in a number of cases where an individual has decided the public, they don't trust the public defender, they don't trust anybody that will be appointed to them, they want to represent themselves through the trial. It's a crazy process, but I've had people do that, up to murder charges. I've gone to trial as advisory counsel for a person that was representing themselves in a murder trial. So in those situations, I'm just sitting there giving them legal advice and making suggestions as to what they should do. But I'm not running the case. I'm just there as a legal encyclopedia, sort of librarian. I mean, I'm there to give them advice relating to what their options are, and then they get to decide what they want to do. So in small claims, you can have a lawyer, but you want to make sure that you get them retained and that they get their paperwork in more than 7 days prior to that first appearance. All right. So the rules of evidence are relaxed in small claims court. So, you know, we've talked about things in the past like hearsay. Hearsay is a super complex issue of the law when you're talking about trial work and you're talking about what it is that you can present in front of a judge as to whether or not that evidence comes into play. And the idea with hearsay is that you're trying to get a statement that hasn't been made in court because you think that it's somehow credible enough that the court should hear it. Well, in small claims court, those rules and sort of keeping those statements out may be relaxed to some degree. But even though they're relaxed, there may be times where the judge says, no, I'm not accepting that evidence, and you really need to have this person here to testify. And you don't really know that until you show up. And most people don't understand sort of that process and how you get evidence into the record relating to documents. Because a lot of people think, well, if I have a document, I should be able to just show it to the judge and it comes in, and whatever is on the document is good evidence and everything should be fine. You know, in regular county court or district court in the state, that may not be the case because those are still hearsay statements in the document themselves. Mm-hmm. But small claims may be a little bit different than that. They may be able to, the court may say, okay, well, tell me about how you got this receipt for something to prove what you've paid. Or, lay the foundation relating to this document so that I can understand what it is. And then the other side has the ability to question you or another witness about it. One of the things that people need to understand with small claims is sort of the procedure is that you have a first appearance date in which you have to show up in person and answer. And you'll do that answer in writing and then pay a fee if you're the defendant.
And both parties must show.
Yeah, exactly.
And if one doesn't, is it over?
It very well could be over.
Okay.
So, most of the time it is over. Yeah. So in the event that you are the plaintiff and you think, oh, well, the defendant just has to answer and then they'll set a court date or something like that, so I'm not going to show up. Not necessarily the case in these small claims matters, that you have to be there in person. And if you don't, the defendant may get the ability to say, well, plaintiff's not here, so dismiss the case. The court very well may do it. It's like a restraining order. You know, when you have a permanent restraining order hearing, so you get a temporary restraining order, you get the person served, and then there's another date within 7 or 14 days of the restraining order. Both parties have to be there. Even if you're represented by counsel, the parties have to be there because you're going to have a hearing on that particular day. It's the same idea with small claims. So you show up. If the defendant doesn't show up, then you get a default judgment against them. And that default judgment, then you have to chase them for that money. So that's always the easiest thing to do a lot of times is get the judgment. The hardest thing is to get somebody to pay for it, especially if they don't have any assets that you can attach to. All right, so that's the first appearance. Normally what happens in the first appearance, if the defendant does answer, then the court will send you off to a mediation. They'll send you off to another party to talk about the case to see if you can resolve it prior to setting it for a final hearing. Probably a lot of times those sorts of cases can get resolved, maybe, in the mediation if you're willing to negotiate, if you're willing to work through the issues. And normally the third party is just someone that does this. They may not even be a lawyer, but they have some skills in mediating these things and trying to get people to come to an agreement and keep talking. So that may be a couple hours of time that you'll have to go through for sure. So then the mediator responds back. If the case doesn't get resolved, then the mediator provides a report to the court, and then the judge then sets a final hearing in which you have to appear, and you have to be ready to go to trial on that particular day. So it's pretty complicated. I mean,
yeah.
even small claims, even though you're talking about a small amount of money, even in the fact that you think that you should be able to prove your case pretty easily, you know, where you see a lot of small claims cases is a dispute with a contractor after you've done a remodel, or maybe an auto mechanic issue, mm-hmm. or other things where someone has done a service for you. Well, a lot of times the people that are making the claim that they weren't given the proper service don't have the expertise to say why. And that's what I run into a lot of problems with, people coming to my office and saying, hey, I've got this small claims case. I want you to help me with it. And for example, in the auto mechanic world, where they say, well, the mechanic didn't do what they said they were going to do. Well, how are you going to prove that? How are you going to show that that's sure. the case when you don't have any experience with auto mechanic stuff? So you have to go get somebody. You have to go get an expert. I mean, you have to go get somebody to testify about that, and you need to have them available on this particular day whenever your hearing is. Hmm. You really should provide the other side with some sort of report relating to that, what that person is going to say, so that they have fair opportunity to be prepared to cross-examine that person.
Right.
You know, it's those sorts of things that even though the rules are relaxed, you don't know what the small claims judge is going to do in regards to what they believe is the characteristics.
Now, what court is it? What court kind of court is this heard in? You mentioned county courts and district courts and all that. So, what kind of court?
Yeah. So it's another. Normally, it's held
in every county. There's a small claims court.
There's a small claims court.
Okay.
Yep. And normally, it's held in one of the county court courtrooms, but on that particular day, they're dealing with small claims cases.
Gotcha.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So how do you, which small claims court do you go to, right, is the first question when you want to sue somebody. Normally, you have to go to the county in which they reside, wherever the defendant resides within the state. Sometimes you can go to the county in which the transaction happens. So let's say you get into a car accident, and it's a really minor accident. The other party doesn't have insurance, and you've got $2,500 worth of damages to your vehicle. For whatever reason, you didn't have insurance that would cover for your damages on your vehicle, and you want to sue the other party. So you first have to go to the county either where the accident happened or where they reside. That would be the proper venue. Then you have to complete the claim paperwork, which you can do, and then you have to serve. A lot of times in small claims, you can do it by certified mail. The best option is to do it by personal service so that you can say the person knows that they were supposed to be there.
Okay, great. Once again, you're listening to Legal Talk with Attorney Kevin Flesh, Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886. Now, who can file a claim?
Yeah.
I mean, is it only like, you know, me against my neighbors, only individuals or can companies or?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So individuals, that's easy. Any human being can do it. A partnership can do it. A corporation can as well. LLCs can as well, but they have to be. So corporations and LLCs, limited liability companies, can file a claim in small claims, but the amount cannot exceed $5,000. So the idea is with those entities is that if it's more than $5,000, they've got to sue the individuals in county court, and a lot of times those entities need to be represented by a lawyer, and that's the whole idea is that the $5,000 or less, they still allow you to be representing yourself, but you've got to have. You know, whenever you set up an LLC, for example, for the Secretary of State, you've got to have a person that's either a manager or a representative, and then the person that will handle the service that will be served with papers and things like that. So you'll have to list that individual in your paperwork to make sure that the defendant knows who they have to serve to complete the process in small claims correctly. Because otherwise, if you have a claim that's more than $5,001, you have to file in county court. And a lot of times under the statute, you'll have to have an attorney represent you there because the entity. The statute just says that you have to have a lawyer there.
So let's say somebody puts something against me for $5,000, and I'm like, they want to go to small claims court, and I'm like, I don't want to. I want to take it to another court.
Yep.
And I remember we had a listener one time contact you, and you were talking about I can get it moved from that court.
Correct.
So how does that work?
Yep.
What's involved in that?
Yeah, so that person, the first thing that you have to realize is that as a defendant, once you're served, you have a limited amount of time to move that matter, because what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to immediately get a lawyer and then have that lawyer in your answer either make a counterclaim that's in excess of the limits of the small claims, or asked to move the matter to county or district court. I've had the situations where you have a counterclaim, for example, where your counterclaim is in excess of the $25,000 limit for county court, and you move it from small claims to district court, because district court is there's no limit on the jurisdiction in district court. It's a subject matter jurisdiction is everything for district court in Colorado. And so we've done that where it starts out at small claims, and as a defendant, you decide, I've got a counterclaim against this other person. It's in excess of county court, which is $25,000 now. So we're going to move it directly to district court, and so you move it out. One of the real dangers for people that begin in small claims court is that your claim, even though it's moved to district court for the defendant, your claim still only has a $7,500 limit, even though you've moved it to higher courts that have higher limits.
Okay.
And the idea there is that the plaintiff gets to decide where they bring the claim. And so if your case is on the margin in the sense of your damages may be $7,500 or it could be $10,000 or $15,000, but you decide, well, it's cheaper and easier to go through small claims. I'll just get the $7,500 and that's okay. I'll waive the rest of it. Well, in some cases, it's substantial. And sometimes once you get into the case and you realize what your damages are, like I've had cases where the individual comes to me after, so they've sued the other entity, the defendant has been served, and before the defendant has to answer, they have a lawyer retained and they put on notice. Then the plaintiff has the right to get their own lawyer. They have another 7 days after that to get their own lawyer. And so I've had people come during that interim period to say, okay, I'm thinking about hiring a lawyer. And we talk about the case, mm-hmm. and it turns out their damages are more like $20,000, not $7,500. And so in those situations, you then have to make a decision about what you do. Because you've now caused your own problem there in that you've limited the amount that you can raise in the way of a claim. In some instances, we've just voluntarily dismissed. You can do that under Rule 41, and voluntarily dismissed and then refiled in a higher court. A lot of times the defense at that point is going to object, saying, hey, you've decided on the venue, too bad. You got to stay in it. And it's a crapshoot as to whether or not the court says, yeah, the defense is right. You don't get to move it. Normally, the court will allow you to dismiss when the defense hasn't really even answered yet. As a matter of course. Now you refile. If you were trying to dismiss on a second go around, you may have to pay costs or fees.
Man, it sounds like such a hat to me. I'd much rather just go, Kevin Flesh, 303-806-8886. Yeah, Kevin, please, you know, because I mean, it's just, man, so much. So I guess, too, you got to figure out what amount of money is worth it to even do it. I mean, for $500. Is it, and again, $500, and sometimes it's principal to people, and I get that and all that, but man, you're going to spend some time there, aren't you?
Right. That's exactly, and that's the other part of it, is when you start looking at the amount of time that you're going to spend. So you go down to the courthouse, you complete the paperwork to begin with. That's going to take you an hour or two. You then show up on the first appearance. That's a couple hour appearance. You then do the mediation. That's a couple hours, maybe longer, but probably a couple hours. Right. So you're 6 hours into it. You then have to prepare the case for trial in the event that you don't get it resolved. There's a couple hours of prep there. And then to go, they don't just set these trials like one afternoon, like you're set, you're the only thing on the docket. They'll set five cases because most of them will either resolve or they'll go away.
You could be first or fifth.
Yeah. So you could be an hour, you could be 5 hours. So you get into this and now you're talking about 10 or 12 hours of time. If literally it's a $500 claim, if you're having to take off now a day and a half, and you make $100 a day, now you've lost a couple hundred dollars worth of time in the way of lost work or capacity. And then you've got to think about the economics of it. Now, same thing. I mean, my hourly rate's $300 an hour. Well, you're not going to pay me. Normally, people don't pay me unless you can get your attorney fees reimbursed. You're not going to pay me $600 to fix a $500 problem.
Right.
I mean, there are few people that will. I mean, we used to have this sort of litigation that people thought it was fun when, you know, things were good, that they would give, you know, the neighbor sort of disputes or something else that people were
I'll call my attorney.
Right.
It's just a cool thing to say.
Exactly. Yeah. And they, you know, they're willing to plunk down money to make life difficult for whoever they're trying to make life difficult for. But normally that's not the case. Normally people are really involved in the case realize that that just doesn't make any sense, and they don't do that. So, but the small claims process is one that takes some time, so you really got to think about it. And that's where the same thing, if you're thinking about filing a small claims action, the other question is, do you have a contract that will allow you to get your attorney fees reimbursed? Because
we've always said, what's in writing, man?
Yeah,
for everything.
Yep. Or you know, for example, we've had this situation where labor disputes, like you're an employee of a place and you get terminated and they don't pay you all of what you have to be paid for your wages. Now, a wage claim, many people think, oh, I can just go to small claims and deal with it there. But they have to go through the correct process under the statute in demanding those wages. And if you do that and then the employer doesn't respond appropriately, you're able to get your attorney fees paid. So mm-hmm. I've had situations where maybe it's a $700 wage claim that the employer ends up having to pay $3,000 or $4,000 in attorney fees because they were just so stubborn about not having to pay. And it turned out that case was worth it for the person for us to do it. We file in county court. We don't deal with the small claims. And they ended up getting their money, plus they ended up getting all of their attorney fees paid. But it's very variable on what exactly we're dealing with, whether it's a contract dispute or something else, and whether or not we can get those attorney fees paid. And those are all, again, discussions that you have in determining whether or not small claims make sense. Because if you're able to get your attorney fees covered, why not file in county court? It's
sure,
a better process. You get discovery. It's not as much time in the courthouse, things like that.
Right. Last minute here. But so if I want to file a small claims case against someone, do I just like send them a certified letter? Well, I mean, how do you have to let them know?
Yeah, so normally, once you file the claim, you have to have them personally served. So you have to have the sheriff take the petition out and serve the person in person.
Okay. Now, can anybody serve something, or does it have to be a sheriff?
So no, anybody can. So the Rule 4 says that anyone over the age of 18 can serve a summons complaint on another party as long as they're not a party to the action. So you can't go out and serve me as a defendant when you're the plaintiff.
Okay.
But you could have, and you could have a family member that's not related to the lawsuit serve, or you could have a friend of yours over the age of 18 show up and serve me. A lot of people, then there's private process servers. We have one that we use on a regular basis that's what their business is. And then you've got the sheriff that'll do civil work. Normally, we don't use the sheriff because they're slow and they're a little bit more expensive.
Right.
Unless we have an individual who we think there's a reason it could be a problem.
Yeah.
And so sometimes the police presence is helpful. They'll actually come to the door and take it from them. But most of the time, we've got other avenues to get people served.
Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Man, a lot. We don't have time to get through here, but maybe we'll pick this up again on another show.
Absolutely.
Kevin. But thank you very much, sir. We appreciate it. Thanks for being with us today for Legal Talk. Once again, folks, always a free consultation. It's Flesh and Beck Law. They've been our personal injury and law firm here. Attorneys, 10-plus years here on KLZ 560. So give them a call. Let them know you heard about them here on Legal Talk, and we would appreciate that as well. 303-806-8886. For Kevin Flesh, my name is Scott Whatley. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Thanks for being with us today for Legal Talk.
Call now for a free consultation with Flesh and Beck Law, 303-806-8886, 303-806-8886, or visit fleshlawfirm.com. That's FLESCH, fleshlawfirm.com. A proven team dedicated to your legal needs.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
With rates on the rise, how do you get the best rate? Take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Did you know that when you get cash out, or your FICO score is below a 740, or you're financing a condo versus a single-family home, it will cost you more in rate and fees? Many lenders are charging more. Stop paying it. At Affordable Interest Mortgage, we have lenders that don't charge. Trying to purchase a second home, or is your loan amount considered a high balance or jumbo? There they go again, charging you more. Take aim, 720-895-0500. Let us show you a loan that doesn't charge more. Seeing a low rate but not reading the small print, only to realize all the extra costs and fees? Again, stop. Call 720-895-0500. Affordable Interest Mortgage. Quit paying fees and closing costs that are unnecessary. Get a low rate without all the extra costs. Let us show you how to save thousands. Call 720-895-0500 now. Affordable Interest Mortgage. 720-895-0500. Serving Coloradans for over 20 years. NMLS 298191, regulated by DORA.
For years now, you've heard me talk about Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center. Hey, this is Scott Watley, and yes, for almost 20 years, Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center has been taking care of our pets. From medical, grooming, boarding, and even training, Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center is your one stop for all of your pets' needs. Not only is their facility state-of-the-art, but now you can download the free Lone Tree Vet app and visit their online store for your pet products and pharmacy needs. You can also have your very own pet portal. Plus, don't forget to read their blogs at LoneTreeVet.com. Do you take your dog on hikes? Check out Hiking the Trail Safely with Your Dog. At Lone Tree Veterinary Medical Center, they believe all pets deserve to have a good life. Call today, 303-708-8050, or check them out, LoneTreeVet.com.
This is KLZ 560, your home station.
This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Protect Your Legacy, brought to you by Blake Harris Law. It is BlakeHarrisLaw.com and the number 833-ASK-BLAKE. Again, that is 833-ASK-BLAKE, and we are glad to have back with us attorney Blake Harris. Blake, how are you, sir?
Scott, great to be back on the show, doing well, having a good summer here. How about yourself?
Yes, sir. Everything has been doing well, and we've gotten quite a bit of rain here in the Colorado area over the last few weeks as well, so things are still pretty green, and it has been a good summer. Just had the All-Star game here recently, and a lot of crowds here in the downtown, but yeah, it is good to see things opening back up for sure.
It's interesting to be back around the crowd. It's nice again getting back to normal life.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. All right. As you know, Blake's been with us a year and a half or so, and we are thrilled to have him on. He is the only estate planning attorney that we work with and deals with asset protection, business law, and crypto. So, Blake, I want to start there because it has been the news a little bit about all the cryptocurrency and Bitcoin and all that. But just kind of take that from your side as when you're trying to protect that with estate planning.
Sure. So cryptocurrency has been around for over a decade, but it's been making more and more headlines recently. Certainly did earlier this year with the big bull run that cryptocurrency went on. The last few months, we've seen a little bit of a pullback, which may just be a temporary thing, I suspect, until some things shake out with how the economy is. But in terms of my practice, yes, we focus on estate planning and asset protection. We do this for traditional families and traditional assets, keeping your home out of probate, keeping your family from reducing the chances that there's a fight that breaks out among your family members. But let's take a few minutes today and just talk about cryptocurrency and how to plan for it in your estate plan. So there's two components of what I'd like to discuss. One is the estate planning portion. The next is the asset protection planning portion. As far as estate planning is concerned, estate planning is about the management and transfer of your assets upon your incapacity or passing away. And when it comes to cryptocurrency, it pretty much boils down to one thing: trust. You need to have another person or company that you trust with your crypto, with your cryptocurrency. Crypto is different than traditional assets where you have real estate that has a deed that's recorded with the county or money that is held behind the walls of a bank vault. With cryptocurrency, it's kept digitally, and so you need to have an access code. You need to have a private key, a code, a password, in order to access that cryptocurrency. So there are four ways that I'm going to discuss that you can use to pass your cryptocurrency. The first one is you can simply give your password to another individual. This is very simple to do. The downside of doing it this way, or the risk associated with doing it this way, is that other individual can take that key and steal your cryptocurrency. So if you don't have somebody you totally trust, then I'm going to recommend you consider one of the other options that I'm going to be going through. The second one is to use a safety deposit box at a bank. Mm-hmm. And what I like about this is that it ensures that the safety deposit box where your password can be found can only be accessed after you pass away. And the way to ensure that nobody goes after it or gets it while you're alive is to have it in your name only, and then a death certificate would be required to open that safety deposit box. One benefit of cryptocurrency is that it's outside the banking system. You don't need the approval of anybody else in order to make a transaction. And this route does require you to use the banking system. But the banking system has some benefits, and it does kind of allow a hybrid model of owning cryptocurrency with some of the protections that the banking system owns. It would require probate when you do it this way, because the probate judge would be the one to release access to the new holder of the safety deposit box, or you could set it up with a trust where the safety deposit box is owned by a trust, and then after you pass away with a copy of your death certificate, somebody can go into your safety deposit box and get your password from the safety deposit box. I would go even one step farther and say what you should do is inside your safety deposit box is put access to a key, a combination for a lock, a hard vault, that this combination is held inside the safety deposit box that can then be used to open up a safe inside of your home, and then inside your home is where you keep your private password. So it's a several-step process that somebody would have to jump through in order to access your cryptocurrency,
right.
And that will give you the benefit of protecting it from someone else being able to take it away, but still a process that ensures that your family members can get a hold of your cryptocurrency. The next option is you can hire a company. You can hire a trust company, or if you don't want to use a trust, you can hire a bank or a person. If you hire a company that's to handle your cryptocurrency when you pass away, the great part about that is they are in the business of being trustworthy. That is their sole and only duty. They'll typically have insurance. If there is any inappropriate action, your beneficiaries can sue and recoup from them. And then the fourth option for protecting your passing your cryptocurrency is through the use of what is referred to as a multi-signature wallet. So in order to access cryptocurrency, you have to open up your wallet. You have a key, you have a passcode that is, let's say, a 10-digit number in order to open up your cryptocurrency wallet. With a multi-signature wallet, the way it works is that you can set it up so that there are three people who each have a key, who each have a code to open up that wallet, and it requires two of the three. So, for example, you could hold one key, you could have your attorney hold one key, and then you could have one of your children hold one key. And the understanding is that nobody is to access that until you pass away. So as long as your attorney and your children don't collude, then they're going to be able to make sure that nobody gets to your cryptocurrency without agreement among several parties. And then each party is going to have to make sure that there's a death certificate or that there's verified that you have passed away before someone can unlock and access your cryptocurrency. So it's a means of diversifying your trust among people and an institution so that there's not one other person who can run off with your cryptocurrency. In addition to having an estate plan that covers your cryptocurrency, you also want to make sure that your power of attorney mm-hmm. addresses your cryptocurrency. You want to make sure that your power of attorney has digital assets listed as one of the powers that your power of attorney can step in and take over in the event that you become incapacitated. Another option is to invest in a crypto hedge fund. By investing in a crypto hedge fund, you get exposure to cryptocurrency. I like hedge funds because crypto is a fast changing area of the law. And if you're not paying attention to all the changes that are going on, you risk having your money held in a currency that's going to flop. And by working with a fund manager, they're going to make sure that as the crypto landscape changes, that your portfolio, your investments adjust to their needs. Now, with this, you also get the benefit of estate planning because that hedge fund is going to have it set up in a way that when you pass away, there's a different beneficiary to step in and take over management, to a different beneficiary that receives the funds from the hedge fund. The last tip I have about estate planning for cryptocurrency is don't list your cryptocurrency directly in your last will and testament, and certainly don't list any private passwords, because a last will and testament gets filed with the court and becomes part of the public record. You don't want to allow just anybody to go in and see what cryptocurrency you owned when you passed away. Again, this is a reason that I generally encourage clients to use a trust as opposed to a will, because a will is a ticket to the probate court. A trust can keep your assets outside of probate and provide other benefits as well, such as asset protection for yourself in certain cases, which I'll talk about here in a couple of minutes, as well as asset protection for your children so that they don't lose anything due to a lawsuit or a divorce. Now, for the people who do understand a little bit about cryptocurrency, the future of estate planning with cryptocurrency is going to be very interesting, because what's going to eventually happen is through the use of smart contracts. This is an electronic contract that is self-executing, so it doesn't require an individual to execute the contract. What will eventually happen is, upon you passing away and the state recording your death certificate or issuing a death certificate for an individual, automatically the funds in that account and that wallet will be sent to the beneficiaries, whether that's to a trust account or directly to another beneficiary, which would have profound effects and changes on my industry, on the estate planning industry. We're not there yet. As far as I know, this application has not been developed yet, but I'm sure that there are several developers who are working on it.
Sure. Once again, you're listening to Protect Your Legacy, and again, brought to you by Blake Harris Law. You can check out that website, blakeharrislaw.com. Highly recommend you do that. A lot of great information on there, but probably one of the most important things is the testimonials of people that Blake has helped. And I'm telling you, you will not find any more section of testimonials on any website where people are so happy with Blake and what he's done to help their family. So I hope you'll check that out. And the number is 833-ASK-BLAKE. So Blake, just 2 or 3 minutes here, but want to check with you. You know, when people maybe are wanting to get into this whole cryptocurrency thing, I mean, how do you suggest the best way for them to find out about it and really have the true facts about it?
Sure. So, I would say a good starting point is my website, blakeharrislaw.com. I have a lot of information about cryptocurrency. It's very simple and easy the way I break it down. Also, follow me on social media, Blake Harris Law on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. I'm constantly putting out information about cryptocurrency, and I break it down in a way that's very user-friendly. If you're interested in learning more about cryptocurrency or investing in cryptocurrency, give me a call, 833-ASK-BLAKE. I'd be happy to talk cryptocurrency. I'm not an investment advisor. I don't make investment recommendations. But if you're interested in learning more about cryptocurrency, feel free to contact my firm or start with viewing my website or my YouTube channel. I put out a lot of great information about cryptocurrency. So I would say feel free to use me as a resource if this is something that you are interested in learning more about. And if it's something you haven't really given much thought to, I definitely recommend that you start learning about it, because it's very much the way of the future. And if you operate a business, I would encourage you to consider accepting payments in cryptocurrency. My firm accepts and has been paid in various different types of cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is the most well-known. Ethereum is a very popular one. Dogecoin gets a lot of attention as well. Lots of different cryptocurrencies out there. And if you are offering yourself up to be paid in this type of currency, there are customers who otherwise would not work with you or may go with a competitor. They will decide to work with you. So it's definitely an exciting time, and it's an opportunity to make a lot of, and it's an opportunity that's going to change how money is handled. It's going to be an opportunity for people who get in it early, and we're still early in the process, to probably make a lot of money.
Absolutely. And also on Blake's website, let me mention, you can get your copy of The Ultimate Guide to Estate Planning and Asset Protection. Blake also offers free lifetime reviews and a free initial consultation. Just mention you heard him here on Protect Your Legacy. So, Blake, as always, great information, sir, and we'll look forward to our next visit.
Thanks so much, Scott. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
You as well, sir. BlakeHarrisLaw.com, 833-ASK-BLAKE. They'll help you plan today to protect your tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today for Protect Your Legacy.
Zip around the neighborhood, commute to work, or ride the trails on an e-bike. Hi, I'm Randy Carancy, founder of eBike of Colorado. E-bikes are electric bikes that are fun and easy to ride. Pedal assist technology flattens the steepest hills. At eBike of Colorado, we have 14 major brands to choose from, and our expert staff will find you the perfect bike. Just try it. Take a free test ride at eBike of Colorado in downtown Louisville next to the historic grain elevator. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Learn more at ebikeofcolorado.com. Just try it.
Rush to Reason, Denver's afternoon rush, today at 3. Now back to Haystack Help Radio.
Welcome back to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. Always a privilege to have Alan Stack in studio with us. You've heard about him for years here on our show with Haystack Help Radio and Sportsman of Colorado. And they are located at Stack Optical, 2233 South Monaco Parkway. The number is 303-321-1578. Alan, we talk about a lot of things on the show with you, but I tell you one thing that I wanted to get with you on just a little bit here is, you know, you do such a great job with the glasses and where they've kind of come over the years. The ones that you made for me, and I don't have a huge, I think I'm like a 2.0 now or right. Something like that. But those glasses that you made, they're not transition. What do they call the?
Changes color?
No.
Progressive.
Progressive, yeah. Yeah. All right. See, I would have lost that contest. The progressive. I mean, and Victoria, she just tells me all the time, every time I put them on, she goes, those glasses look so neat. And I remember you had the same frame for a while that you made for me. But those progressive glasses, those are really, really nice, aren't they?
Yeah. And boy, they improved them a lot from, you know, it was just 5 years ago. I think we've had two or three different generations of progressives, and they keep cleaning them up.
Mm-hmm.
So you get more distance, more intermediate. And
you hardly even know you've got them on your face. I mean,
you're also talking about the frame.
Yeah.
That silhouette frame, that's what I'm wearing right now.
Yeah.
I've been using those since 2002. I was one of the first to bring them in. I thought it was just an ingenious design, especially with the type of lens that we use is unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they call it Trivex. But it's just such a strong lens. The optics are so superior.
Yeah, I mean, they're so
clear. And they're so lightweight.
Right.
And another nice thing about the frame is, you know, they come up with new styles and this kind of stuff, but they never change the drill holes. So, you know, somebody can take that frame and use it for 10 or 15 years. If the frame breaks, okay, no problem. Buy a frame. We can use the same lenses in it.
Right.
It's really a well-designed frame. They're not the cheapest, but they sure are the best.
Absolutely, they are great. Now, we've mentioned this before, but you have your on-site lab. So again, you can take those, and I brought last time I had my prescription. Mm-hmm. You took the same, you made the different lens and made it just a little bit bigger for me to give me a little more reading space there. And I mean, there's nowhere that could.
Yeah,
give
so
me that's
touch. That's what's kind of neat with having our own lab. I can customize lenses. You know, decide. Yeah, I really like the shape, but I wish it was a little deeper.
Yeah.
Or a little bit wider. We'll just use that same frame and I'll make it a little bit deeper, a little bit wider. Or we'll change the shape altogether.
Yeah.
Again, having our own lab makes a huge difference.
For sure. I want to talk about tints a minute, because I'm going to be honest. Before I met you, I never even thought about tents. Now, I wore a couple of different, hunting, just the orange or the yellow, whatever. But most of the time, in just a sunglass, just whatever 7-Eleven hat. And, man, I'm telling you what, you changed my life with just the...
Knowing the proper tents for what you do.
Exactly.
That's huge. You know, I can't tell you times golf. No. I was sitting out there on a golf course, and the guy's got gray lenses on, and he can't find his ball. And I'm pointing the ball out for him. And I'm looking, and I said, have you ever heard about, golf lenses? Oh, no. Basically, they're brown. What brown does is help illuminate the shadows that ball falls into. A gray darkens the shadows.
Right.
That's why brown is so much better for golf. Brown is also great for hunting.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be out there in a dark sunglass trying to scope a ridge.
Sure.
You're going to miss the animals. But the brown helps cut through those shadows.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the other hand, let's say you're out on the ocean, you want a nice gray polarized lens.
Yeah.
You want to protect from the sun.
Sure.
And it depends. If it's just driving, no, I prefer gray.
Right.
Gray gives you the truest colors.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm being active in sports, brown is better.
Right.
But again, it depends on what you're doing.
Right.
And that's what we need to discuss.
Absolutely.
It's just like the green lenses. Those came out in World War II. The reason they came out was so that pilots could be able to tell what type of clouds they were flying through. Green actually allows them to see the cloud, different types of clouds.
Really?
That's where green came from. So, and actually, some people really prefer the green. So we do a lot of green.
Wow.
So, tints and polarization, right. It's like, a private pilot. You don't want to put them in a polarized lens. And the reason for being is they need those reflections off the wings to tell if they've got ice buildup. So we typically, if somebody says, I'm a private pilot, no, you don't want polarized.
Right. So anytime you get on a small plane, ask the pilot.
If you weren't polarized, I think I'll go
to stack
off.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, let's talk about contacts for a minute, because a lot of changes noticed through the years. I mean, what were the first contacts like when you started?
Actually, when I started, my father had a contact lens, hard contact lens, manufacturing in the basement of that building that we were in.
Wow.
We used to make the old hard contacts. They were made out of just plastic, PMMA. They didn't breathe. And the only way the cornea could get the oxygen is through tear flow. So you have a lot more red eyes, and especially in our dry environment. So we would put these little holes in the contacts to try to help them breathe. That was the beginning of contacts. Then gas permeables came out, where oxygen could actually get through the lens, which was better. And then, of course, our soft lenses. And I don't know, there's just been so many different advances now that, they've got contacts with a higher water content, much better for you. That's all kind of stuff that doc's involved in.
But right, right.
I was involved in that in the 70s and 80s.
Wow, that's cool. Now, as far as the exam, let's talk about that a minute, because again, $69, and how you've been able to stick with that for all these years, I don't know, to be honest with you.
That's all on the doc. He just loves what he does.
Man, that's a very thorough exam.
We don't use text. The doc sees you from beginning to end. And, I've always sought out doctors that are semi-retired.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it because they love it.
Sure.
They're not doing it, because they got to. They got to make money and this kind of stuff. Typically, they're all... I just love doing optometry. That's what I look for.
Right. That's the kind of doctor you want, too.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And, we've talked about it before, but, boy, you talk about a window to your health. You can see a lot of things through the eye.
Yeah, no, our docs picked up on a lot of things, and then we refer out to MDs and that type of thing. But, when you go in for your eye exam, that's one of the things he does, whether you get dilated or not.
Right.
He's still looking in the back of the eye. If he sees something that's curious, he's going to really... say, hey, let's get the dilation and really take a look at it. And then if he is concerned enough, he's off to the MD.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but, you're only starting at $69.
I know.
One of the reasons I started doing that is because a lot of the MDs, they were charging, $200 and $300 for the eye exams. And they weren't doing the eye exams. They were having their techs do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the doc would walk in and go, yep, that looks good. Sign the prescription.
Right.
But you paid to see the doctor. And I had so many people start complaining about that because a lot of the older ophthalmologists that did that were retiring. And the younger ones are so into using their techs, they're more into the surgery than the eye exam.
Right.
That's why typically an optometrist, in my opinion, you get a better eye exam because that's all they do.
Sure.
So that's really worked out well for us. And our doc has picked out quite a few things that we've referred on.
Right. And also, I mean, hey, we're getting that time of year now. You're seeing a lot of people on motorcycles and out riding their bikes and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you've got a ton of glasses for, again, enhancing your experience in the outdoors.
Exactly. I mean, depending on what you do, I've got a pair of glasses for it. somebody was commenting just yesterday about my motors, or they were going, what, are those motorcycle glasses? I said, actually, I brought those in for open cockpit pilots, flying the old biplanes.
Oh, okay.
But they look like, and they are, the old motorcycle glasses back from the turn of the century. They're a leather frame with the metal inserts that I could put, you know, prescriptions in. But, some motorcycle guys really like that now because it's true.
Sure.
But I brought them in because of open cockpit pilots that I had back in the 90s.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, no, depending on what you do, I've got a pair of glasses.
Right, right. Now, I know we've done the Stack Sports Pack for quite a mm-hmm. while. But
yeah,
I
and they've changed it a little bit.
But they've changed it, and so I want yep. you to talk about that a little bit. And I'm telling you, because, man, that I keep that in my truck, and, I mean, that's all I need.
Yeah, no, what I really liked about the original one, it was a flatter base curve. But on the other hand, I had many customers that say, well, I want more of a wrap. Well, they've discontinued the flatter one, and now we just have more of the wrap.
Okay.
Which is okay, unless you have a high correction. Then I've got to do something different.
All right.
But no, they've just basically changed their style, I think, basically mm-hmm. because people were complaining about it. With me, I was putting so many prescriptions, and I like the flatter.
Right. And basically, though, it's still the concept of one
yeah.
frame. And
one
being
frame
able to switch the lenses.
Lenses.
And when I tell you, folks, when you know, sometimes you think, well, yeah, an optometrist can switch the lenses. I can't. No, I'm telling you, I can. Right. So you can. It's so easy. And right there in the field, I've done it. You know,
right.
been in a blind or something like that, you know, waterfowl hunting or whatever, and all of a sudden the weather changes, clouds change, whatever. Man, I've unzipped my case, boom, boom, stuck another lens in there, and been able to do what I need
yeah,
to do.
Yeah, there's two different ways you can do that. You know, you can get like a dark brown, and then a clear that you want to use right in the early morning or late evening. But we've also come up with new types of sun-sensitive lenses that'll change for you so you don't have to change it. But you're right. That's the ease of that frame is being able to change lenses out. Or you've got your hunting lens, but then let's say you have your fishing lens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just switch them.
Yeah, Kevin Flesh loves right. his too. I
yeah.
mean, Kevin's
yeah,
with us.
Yeah, works out really well.
Yeah, yeah, he loves his. Once again, it's Stack Optical, and really, truly, for all of your optical needs, whether it be repairs, your eye exam, your contacts, hey, they can take care of you. Don't trust your eyes just to anyone, all right? Do it. Trust your eyes to someone, hey, that I do and that has been doing it since 1968. And Al and his crew will be ready to help you. Need to call for an appointment, 303-321-1578. And as Alan said, during their hours there, and I think you're open till 5:30, right?
Uh-huh, 5:30 okay. during the week yeah, and 5 o'clock on Saturday.
All right. So, hey, if you're in the area and need something, hey, tap on the door. They'll probably try to help you. But no doubt, this is the place you need to go to for all your optical needs. Hey, family-owned and operated. They care about you. They care about customer service, and they will take care of you. So 303-321-1578, and it's stackoptical.com. Alan, always good to see you.
Thank you, Scott.
We look forward to our visit next time. Thank you so much for being with us today for Haystack Help Radio. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Leave it right here on KLZ 560.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.